my name is Terry Shelton, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Terry.
Should I wear it?
No, she's scolding me.
I just told her to take a picture after the meeting.
Kids. Hey, real quick, I need to say a prayer. Because I am, you know, these are my people. You know what I mean? I'm not really nervous. I just want to do it right. You know, and that's just one of my character defects. It really is. And sometimes they're glaring. Sometimes they help me meet people that I can work with, and sometimes they just glare for the hell of it. I set aside everything I think I know for an open mind and new experience. Please help me see the truth about myself, and most of all about you, God. You know, I don't usually like to go into like long drunkalogues and stuff because, you know, we all know how to drink. I do feel that it's necessary for me to let you get to know me, because I've never done that here. It's taken me 3 years in this group to get this, and it's taken me 47 years to get it. But it's for this year, and I've been coming here for 3 years, and I've never told my story. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just going to tell it short and sweet, and then get to where it's. I'm hot.
We know. Quit bragging.
Mama. You know, and I'm at that time in my life where I have my own personal summer. You know. So. Not pretty. But it's better than when I was drunk, let me tell you. You want to see not pretty. Tequila Terry used to call me.
Is that too much?
Does Tequila Terry home?
No.
He never knew. He never knew what he was going to walk into. You know, I was a strange kid.
No.
I got chubby at age 5. You know, I was the firstborn. We lived in Chicago, and then we moved back to St. Louis, and my mom and dad were young when they got married, and they were forced to get married because my mom got pregnant with me. You know, and so they always tried to lie and say they were married one more year than they really were. You know, like I'm an idiot, because they would slip up, you know, and yeah. 17 years. No, it's 18 years, yeah. So it was just weird because they did that because it was a shotgun wedding. Literally, my grandpa said, "You will marry my daughter." And my dad did it, you know. So the first year of my life, I wasn't really around my dad. I lived in Kentucky with my mom because they didn't know each other, you know. These two people met at a funeral. They met at my uncle's funeral. So they were cousins by marriage. So can somebody say the gene pool needs bleach? They weren't really related, but they were cousins by marriage, okay? So that's something that, you know, I knew my whole life. Okay, so, you know, I was a weird kid. I just was a weird kid, you know, and I was a thief. I was a thief as a kid. You know, you could not take me somewhere. My mom would take me to Target. I stole a little leather bracelet that said Libra on it. Libra, that's my sign. I was like 6. You know, my mom marches me back in, pulling me by my ear, and says, "You return this right now." And I had to give it back to the lady, and I was like, you know. Anyway, every time I went somewhere, I would steal stuff. It's that entitlement issue. You know, my parents were poor. I mean, my dad put himself through college, and then he went and worked on the railroad. Then he became a salesperson. But he, you know, they had 3 kids, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom, so they didn't have much money. And I don't know. I've always had this thought and this fear that there's not going to be enough. There's not going to be enough for me. You know, and you know, and to tell you the truth, when I was drinking, I never did get enough alcohol. Never. I never did get all I wanted. So that's my entitlement issue. And I really related when you said that, Leslie. And didn't she do a really good job?
Yeah.
You know, it's awesome. You know, I hated sports. I was quirky. I was chubby. You know, and by the time I got, I wasn't a really great student because I was lazy. You know, and my parents were, they were young parents. They did the best they could. You know, what you don't know, you don't know. And they didn't know much when it came to parenting kids. You know, and it was like, you know, they always said, you've got to be the example for the younger two. You've got to do good. You've got to be an example. Otherwise, we're just screwed. You know? The first one can't turn out rotten apple because then all of them are going to be bad. You know? And that was their attitude. And I would just be like, you know, I'm that personality type. You know, you tell me to do something, I'm going to do that over there. And that's how I did it. And finally, I drank when I was a freshman in high school. And my mom and dad were getting a divorce. And I went up to my friend Tina's house, and we drank vodka and orange juice. And I was 14. I could have used a drink before kindergarten, but I didn't take that. I mean, I was really uptight the whole time, you know? Anyway, so, but I was 14, and now I waited a long time, and I had a drink, and I drank vodka and orange juice. And we drank on her deck, and it had a pergola with grapes, you know, and I was like, this is it. You know, suddenly I felt, A part of. I felt something inside me actually clicked, you know, and my brain mapped that saying, hey, this is the answer. Here's your solution, you know, and it was my solution for a long time. I ended up blacking out and getting sick, and Tina had to bring me home, and my parents were out of town. They were at marriage counselors or marriage, whatever that, what marriage encounters. Gosh,
marriage,
yeah, because they used to one ring each other, and that meant that they loved each other or something. And we'd be like, you know, who's hanging up on us? But nuts.
I get it.
Yeah, where you give your spouse one ring to let them know you love them during the day, and my mom would be at home smoking pot, like, just let it ring. So, needless to say, they got divorced. And my mom was actually the first person to smoke pot with me. She had this deal. She was like, I was telling, you know, I was like, I want to smoke some pot. You know, it's 1979, and my mom was like, well, I'll smoke it with you the first time, because I just want to know how you're going to react on it, you know? And then she started telling me this shit, like, because once you open this door in your brain, it never closes again all the way. What does that mean? So that made me want to do it more. You know? Who cares if that door shuts or not? So I was like, okay, let's do it. Let's do this already, you know? So we did, and, you know, and I was paranoid, and I got sick, and then she wanted to take me shopping, and I was like, you know, I didn't want to leave the house. And it was just messed up. So I went back to drinking. You know, it was much more my speed. Anyway, I did sell pot on the side. Every year in high school, I got busted for selling pot. And then I would steal my mom's diet pills, and I would sell those at school. See, I had this entitlement issue that I was owed something. You know, that being the firstborn, being whatever I was, I don't know, but everybody owed me something, you know, and I was going to get mine, you know, and I was completely self-centered and selfish. I mean, totally. You know, my parents would beg me, please just try to set a good example for your sisters. And I would basically just say, you know, screw you. I'm going to do what I want to do, you know, and now I think about it now, and you know, it's just a sad existence, for real. But I ended up quitting high school and getting a GED. It was boring, you know. So I quit and I got my GED, and I ended up getting pregnant. I got pregnant and I had a baby in 1983. And I'd like to say that slowed me down for a while, you know, drinking and stuff, but You know, it really didn't. It just, it did for a few months, but then, you know, the whole time I was drunk, I smoked pot. You know, I'm going to be honest. You know, I went years without saying that. You know, I didn't tell anybody the first time around. Pregnant. When I was pregnant, I smoked pot. Yeah. I didn't drink, and I thought that I was doing so good. Because that's what I wanted, was a drink, you know? And I was a dry drunk. Oh, my God. I remember my boyfriend at the time, his baby daddy or whatever they call it now. He was like, he would go out, you know, or whatever, and I would be so pissed. I would take the peanut butter jar. Because I would be eating peanut butter or garlic bread at 10 in the morning or some crazy stuff. Because, you know, I wasn't raised, you know, to know what to eat when I was pregnant, really. My mom, you know, didn't really teach me those things. And then I was a dry drunk, you know. I would just throw peanut butter jars and throw shit at the wall and just be crazy, lunatic, crazy mad, you know. And I didn't have a God in my life, but I didn't have any way to communicate. I could not communicate to other people. Unless I was loaded, you know. And so, after I had my son, I started shoplifting. Because I was needing a drink, and I didn't have any money. So what I would do is I would go to the store, the grocery store in St. Louis, and I'd bring a big purse, which I still carry big purses today. But anyway, I don't shoplift. But anyway, I would take a big purse, and I'd go, and I'd grab a carton of cigarettes, and 2/5 of booze. You know, usually it was peppermint schnapps at that age, and then it graduated up to whiskey and tequila, whatever. Anyway, I got away with this a bunch of times. You know, even in high school, I got away with it a bunch of times. I was really pretty good at it. And then my parents were divorced, and my mom decides, you know, she's not going to get food for the house. She's not going to do, you know, she's just going to do her own thing. So we would have to shop with food and clothes and stuff then at that time. So I became, you know, pretty good at it. And I really thought I could do it when I was drunk. If I had a few drinks in me, I'd try to steal a Hummer. Put it in my purse. You know what I mean? I thought I could do it. You know? I mean, there's that one joke. When I was loaded, I would try to put a canned ham up my dress or something. That's crazy. Not really. There's an urban legend, and it says that canned ham falls out, and then somebody's like, "Who threw that ham at me?" That's what the lady says. It's kind of a funny story. Because it fell out of her dress, and she's like, "Who threw that ham at me?" So, but no, I didn't take a ham, but not yet. That's a yet. But what I did do is I got caught. I got caught stealing liquor and cigarettes, and so they put me in prison because I've been caught before. So they put me into Gumbo, which is a man woman's prison. It's not like it's a prison, a real prison, but it's not like I don't know, the penitentiary. It's like a medium pit prison, you know, where you're still behind fences and stuff, and you're in dorms, but you're not really like on lockdown, you know, with bars and stuff. But anyway, it was bad enough. I was there for 2 weeks, and I am not penitentiary material. That's one thing I found out for sure. You know, there was no pedicures, no manicures, nothing like that in prison. Anyway, I made a deal with my PO. I got a PO then, and I made a deal with her that I would go to treatment. This was 1984, and my son was 11 months, and they put me in the state hospital on Arsenal Street in St. Louis in 1984, and so I was in there with the nuts, you know, and I did my treatment. I wasn't serious. I actually met a guy in there, and
of course.
We were in love.
Of course.
And, you know, we were going to quit this, do this thing together and you know, be together forever and everything. And me and what's his name? I don't even know his name now. So it's like, it did not work. I ended up going to beauty school. get out of prison, go to beauty school. So I went to beauty school, and I actually slowed down a little bit with that, you know, because I had to focus, and I was doing something that I really liked. So I kind of cut back on the drinking, and I was switching the stuff up. You know how we do it, you know, with other outside issues, and switching around, and so I could function and do some stuff and get a good grade. And I got a really good grade, and I actually got hired by a salon that my mom and I used to go to when we first moved back from Chicago. So it was a neat salon, and you know, I worked there for 4 years, and I started really partying there and going out to bars, and ended up turning 21 in a bar that I had drank in for 2 years already. That guy was pissed. But anyway, so it got bad for me, though, you know. In 1990, I hit a really bad bottom. I had lost my job by then. My sister was going to take my son from me, and she should have. He was 7 years old, and I wouldn't take him to school. I wouldn't cook him food. I would buy food, and I would put it in the house, and I'd say, hey, I'm a great mom. There's food in the house. You know what I mean? But I would be drunk or blacked out or passed out, and I wouldn't cook, and I wouldn't take care of him. And she was ready to take him from me. And I actually sat there in my bedroom, and I thought, this is my life. This is it. This is it. I might as well make the best of it. You know what I mean? And I guess I'm not meant to have kids. You know, and I mean, these thoughts actually went through my mind that there wasn't going to be any other different way, you know, that this was it. And I saw this commercial, of all things, and I had been through treatment once before, but I did not pay attention. And I had just damaged myself so bad. You know, I mean, I had quit my job and stayed home to drink, got on welfare so I could drink all day and all night. I would drink and sleep maybe 2 or 3 hours and drink some more. I had bottles hit all over the house, and I really hit a bad bottom. I saw this commercial where this dude's sitting on this was the 90s, so this guy's sitting outside of a vacant home, a bandominium or whatever it is, and he's like talking about cocaine and how he lost everything, you know. And I thought, oh my God, that's kind of what's happening to me. You know, so I called the Highland Center, St. Anthony's Hospital, and I said, I want to come into treatment. And they said, okay, can you come right now? And I was like, well, no, I gotta get my affairs in order.
Whatever.
If you would have seen this place, you know, my affairs, you know, like throw the pizza boxes away. So, I mean, they're like, can you come tomorrow? And I said, yeah, I'll come tomorrow. So I called my mom, and she gave me a ride up there, and they had to do a medical detox, and I seized. And I went and had a grand mal seizure while I was in the hospital. And but they were right there, you know, so everything was all cool in the gang. And then they shipped me off to a free treatment center, and I spent 30-something days there. And I started AA. And I started AA, and fear kept me sober for a bit, because that was very scary. You know, I mean, I had just been diagnosed with cirrhosis, 27 years old, you know, and had a distended liver, and I couldn't stop drinking long enough to even take antibiotics. You know, I mean, they'd say, take antibiotics. Well, you can't drink with them, so they're not getting taken, you know. So I did AA, and what I did was I joined a group, and I went once a week. You know, I went to the meeting once a week, and I got a sponsor, and we worked the steps. And my deal was, she worked the steps with me through the daily reflection. And there's no directions in the daily reflection. You know? I mean, I don't think you can work the steps wrong. You know, I think if you work them, you're working them. But I never tapped in. I never tapped into that, you know. My whole deal was, that whole time, I thought that I was going to come in here and work these steps
and work these steps and work these steps and work these steps, and I was going to make myself better. You know, I thought that I would, that I was supposed to wake up every morning, make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I didn't get up and do a, write out my plans or pray. I just said, okay, one more day, let's do this, you know, and I was running things as normal. You know, I wasn't pausing and asking, you know, and how I stayed sober for 10 years, I have no idea. It was a fluke. I went to meetings, but I hated them. I hated them. And I hated them because I didn't have a message. I didn't have a message to carry. You know, I had, what I had was bullshit. You know, I would sit there and say things like, you just gotta want it bad enough. If you want it bad enough, you can get it. I wanted it, you know. I mean, I actually never saw the big book open enough where I would read it. You know, I had the promises underlined, and they were dangled in front of me. Ding, 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 do the steps, and you too can have these, you know, like a little carrot. And I never, you know, I never felt like I feel now. I never felt a connection with the power that was the power that was going to remove my problem. You know, I always felt like, I wasn't always like white knuckling it, dying it for a drink. You know, God had done for me what I couldn't do for myself. I just wasn't praising him for it. I wasn't giving him, you know, I wasn't, you know, saying thank you. You know, I'm thinking, I'm taking credit for the whole deal. You know, I came in here and I worked these steps and I am sober. And that's how I did it. And I spoke every one of those 10 years. You know, and nobody ever shook me or smacked me or anything. You know, and I relapsed. I lost a job that I was really, it was a job in a hair salon at John. I got in a car accident in my 9th year and I got on Vicodin. And, by the end of my 9th year, so I don't even say that I have 10 years sober, I had 9 years. Because I was chewing those things like M&M's. Mm-hmm. And eventually, of course, I grabbed a drink because that's what I want. So I drank, and I lost everything again. You know, and I had done the steps my first time around, did all of my steps and made amends, made financial amends. You know, I was working it, you know, so I had all that done, but I never worked with anybody else. I had maybe one sponsor, I think, by about 2 years. I never went out and tried to find any. I never, you know, I never had a strong enough message that somebody would come up to me and say, will you take me through this book? Will you be my sponsor? You know, I was just babbling a bunch of mystical bullshit, really. You know, I mean, that's really what I was doing in the meetings, and I hated to go anyway. So, I mean, it was just, you know, it was drudgery to me. So I drank, you know, and it was awful. It was like I never quit. It was shit. In no time, it was shit. And it took me 3 years to get back again. And then I got back, and I was in, that was in 2003. And I joined another fellowship because I'm thinking my problem's pills now, because that's why I relapsed. It's not Terry, you know. It's something out here.
Yeah.
So that's the deal, you know. It wasn't me. I was still blaming my parents. You know, my mom sitting me down saying, I'm going to become a prostitute. You know, or my sister moving out and leaving me with my mom. And, you know, all these other things that were happening. I'm still blaming all this stuff, you know. And I had my entitlement issue going on big time. Even when I was sober for that 10 years, I still stole stuff. Spiritual, huh?
What?
was a better horse case.
That was pretty good. Unfortunately. You know, and I've never been this honest, you know, but you guys are my people. This is my home group. I got sober again in 2003, and I lived in an Oxford house for 18 months, and then I met my husband, and I moved to Kansas. And I was in another fellowship for over 5 years, and I did it even worse. I didn't even work the steps. I did 1, 2, and 3 like 4 times. And then I would change sponsors and be like, you know, they'd be like, you gotta get going on this 4-step, gotta get going, you know, and oh man, you're harsh. You know, this isn't a race, you know. What's the hurry? You know, and I would just change sponsors. So I was like, in another fellowship, I had 3 different sponsors. They were all wonderful, lovely ladies. And I guess it was 2009. Shit hit the storm with our business. We own a business. And things kept crashing down on me. And so I picked up pills again. So it almost doesn't feel just as bad. You know what I mean for me? And but before you know it, I'm drinking again. And I'm drinking for just a few months, 6 months or so, maybe 3, 6 months, something like that. And my health has just gone to shit. And I thought, you know what? I can't do this. I was sitting in my office and I was thinking, is this all there is? You know, I mean, I still had all my stuff, you know, but my spirituality, my inside was empty. I was bankrupt. I didn't have any friends. I didn't have any relationships, even with my family, because this is alcoholic torture. And Thanksgiving, my husband and I were driving to St. Louis for Thanksgiving dinner. I finished off the end of a fifth of VO early in the morning, you know, because I got a little bit of a hangover from the night before. So I finished it off. We get in the car, we're going. We stop at every other gas station on Highway 70. And I get a pint. And I down it. You know? By the time we're in Columbia, he's like, are you drinking? I'm driving too, so he can tell. That's true. No. And we get to my family's house. And I can't drink alcohol in front of my family because they know that they know me sober. I've been sober 10 years. You know, I can't drink alcohol in front of them. And they have alcohol all over the place. It's Thanksgiving. The craving is on. I just drank all the way down there. It's 7 o'clock at night and there's nothing I want more than a drink. I can't have it. You know? And I just thought, man, this is it. I'm completely powerless over this shit. It has mastered me. And it made me, it brought me right to this place in Bill's story. No words can tell the loneliness and despair found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. And I knew it. Now, I was as hopeless as Bill was at that point in time, and I was that hopeless that Thanksgiving, so much so that I ended up leaving my family that I don't see all the time. They live 4 hours away. Going to a hotel room and drinking. And then going home and trying to ice the whole thing over, saying, well, you know, it's not a big deal. We just kind of have to, you know, my aunt, and they all know. And you can imagine they were trusting me again, you know. They trusted me. I had keys to their house, you know. I mean, all kinds of stuff again, you know. And here I was, you know, doing it again. Anyway, so I came in here in April. I guess it was 2010 or whatever. And I sat in a meeting, first step meeting, and a lot of the people that were in that first step meeting are here right now. know. I came to some meetings. That was on a Monday. And then I came to a meeting on Tuesday, and I saw Teresa, and she was reading her, she had her big book all marked up and crazy. And she was all, and she was jumping and sharing like 14 times.
No.
But that's what I wanted. You know, that's what I needed. That's what I wanted. I wanted to have a message. I needed a message of depth and weight, you know. Because I had bullshit before. And you guys have all heard that story about the talking dog, right? Right?
Yeah. No.
I told you that story.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, there's this, this guy's driving in the country, and there's a sign, he runs across the sign that says, talking dog for sale. Right? So he pulls over, and he's like, stops at this guy's house, and he's like, where's this talking dog? I want to check it out. And he's like, it's back in here in the back in the carport. So he goes back there, and the dog's back there, and he's like, so you can talk, huh? And the dog's like, yeah, I sure can. I learned some nuances of the language, and I built one verb on another, and I learned nouns, and now I can say all the words in the English language, and I've actually had a really great life, and I've eaten in the finest restaurants, and I even worked at the UN as a translator for a while, and I've just lived in New York for a couple of years, and now I'm back here. And the guy was like, you know, and he's like, now I have pups, and my pups are actually bilingual. And the guy's like, whoa, you know, that's crazy. So he walks back to the guy that owns the dog, and he's like, he is amazing. How much for a dog like that? And the guy goes, $20. And he's like, for a dog like that? And he goes, yeah, you don't believe all that shit he just told you. You know? So I gotta have a message of depth and weight in order to get anything done here, you know? And I've gotta be able to get something done here and get some people that I can give this message to in order to keep it. I relapsed since Teresa was my sponsor. She planted a seed. She definitely did, and she hooked me up. And I drank again. It takes what it takes, you know. And I'm a retread, you know. And sometime in the future, me being a retread is going to help another retread, mm-hmm. You know. And I have to believe that, you know. And I asked Liz to sponsor me. And she said yes, and we've been going at it ever since. I've relapsed once with Liz. But then when I relapsed once with Liz, we had gotten to the second step and I relapsed. So I went back to Liz and said, she said, okay, I said I relapsed. And she goes, okay, now what are you going to do? You know, and that's exactly what I needed. And, you know, I kept having this drama in my life with people around me not being able to stay sober, you know, and I would do things to sabotage my own sobriety out of spite or out of jealousy or out of, I'll show you, you know, that spite, you know, you want to see bad. So, you know, I continued to work with Liz, and she didn't take me back to step one that time. She continued me on to step three. She doesn't know why she did it. I don't know why she did it. But that very next day, we went to a treatment center, and I found this in the book. I hadn't seen it yet, or it hadn't popped out at me. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how are we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. That means we have written a book which we believe is spiritual as well as moral. It means, of course, that we're going to talk about God. And, I didn't like talking about God. You know, it gave me the creeps. I did not want to be some holy roller person, you know. I was not into it, and I was like, you know, I never noticed this in the book, and I was reading this out loud to a girl in the treatment center, and something came through me and said, see, it says, the power greater than yourself will solve your problem. Not that you're going to solve your problem. I'm saying this to this person with one day clean. Not that, you know, that she's going to help you solve your problem. And I'm like thinking, it's going to solve my problem. Mm-hmm. And I had to hear my voice say it. And when I heard my voice say it, I was like, it was almost like Eureka. You know, 16 years. Jesus. I'm saying this is amazing to me. You know, this is freaking huge. He's gonna solve my problem. I'm not gonna come in here and work these steps, and the more I work these steps, the more sober I'm gonna get. That's what I thought. You know, I thought, I drank real bad, so I need to get real sober. God's going to solve my problem. God solved my problem. God, you know, my sponsor said God removed me from alcohol. That's how Bill says it. God separated me from alcohol. God separated me from alcohol. Without God, I wouldn't have sobriety day. You know, and God can be anything you want it to be. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, what's popular. It can be anything. And I took that and I ran with it. And I had a spiritual experience like crazy with the third step. And what it was an aha moment. And it was all night long. And I was telling you about this the other night. Up all night, putting things together. You know, it was like, this piece fell into place. This piece fell into place. And I was like, oh my God. You know? Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. Made a decision. I only have to make that decision one time. I only have to make it once. That I'm going to let God be my God, and I'm going to show God that He can be my God by working step four.
Yes.
That's what I'm going to do. So I only have to make that decision one time. You know, I say the third step prayer over and over as an affirmation of my decision that I made. But I only made the decision once. You know, I thought that to get to step three, I would already have to have this deity and this this religious, all this religion and all this Bible knowledge and all this stuff, you know, already in place. You know, I thought it was the Terry Lama. You know what I mean? That everything was, I was so spiritual, you know, and being my child, you know. And I mean, just real, before I could do step three. That's what I thought it had to be. But it wasn't, because this was my spiritual experience, is that turn my will and my life, which is my thinking and my actions, over to the care of God as I understood Him, as I understand Him now. I just met Him. I just met Him in step two. I just met Him. So I just have to have this much willingness. And I can wing it and say, lead me where you need me, and, you know, where are we going today, and this stuff, because He's my God, and I just had to have this much willingness. And it's the God from step two. It didn't have to be the Pope. The Pope's God. You know, I didn't know that, because I thought when I turned my will and my life over to the care of God, that He was going to turn me into a missionary and send me to India or China or some shit. I had all this built up, and for years I thought this, you know? Oh, I don't want to do that, you know? And it just one decision, one time, and I got it. It clicked for me. You know, God gave it to me. And it was 4 a.m, I'm wide awake. This is the God from the second step. This is the God from the second step, as I understand Him, is how I understand Him now. Because I don't understand God. This is the God from the second step in my step three. And I haven't had the obsession to drink since then. You know, and I did step four, I did step five, and I've done all the steps, and I've made all my amends. You know, I had a list of 23 amends to make on my ninth step, and I took them 3 at a time into prayer with me. And I would say the prayers and ask for the, you know, the strength and the willingness and everything to go on with them. And I knocked them out.
then I kind of wavered on a couple and started a big book study, and I found that I was a little resistant in that area and decided, you know, get it done. You know, get it done. And so I did. And these promises in this book, there's so many promises. There's promises all over the place, you know, and it's just amazing how they come true. You know, and the steps, you know, when I was standing on this side of step one, everything, all those steps were contrary to everything that I believed. I came in here saying, I'm not doing four, I'm not doing five, I'm not doing eight, nine. You know, I'm not doing them. And once I did one, and I had to do one thorough, you know, I mean, I had to really realize from page 0 to 43, they're telling me that I do not think and I do not drink like normal people. You know, and I had to really get that in this thick ass brain of mine. That on my own power, what I will do is drink. And I've proved it. I'm a retread, remember? I've taken my power back. I've never given it over. And was graced and blessed with some sobriety. Or some clean, dry time, whatever you want to call it. Sobriety. You know, so I mean, and now what's different this time? What's different is I'm working with other people. I have a message of depth and weight. I'm not the talking dog. You know, not at all. And I mean, I'm not trying to be arrogant. All I'm saying is that when something comes up in my life, I have answers now. I have a higher power in my life. You know, my sponsor has taught me to turn my face towards God. And what I'm doing now is at night I write down an inventory every night. And sometimes, like during the day, like I won't do mean shit or pesky shit to people because I don't want to write it down on the inventory. You know what I mean? I write down an inventory at night, and then in the morning I get up and I say my prayers. Oh shit. I say my prayers and then I write down what I'm going to do all day.
Don't look at the clock.
And
stop it.
And then I meditate, and I start out with 2 minutes, and I'm up to, like, honestly, like 6 minutes, really. I had 10, but I relapsed a little bit because, long story. Anyway, you know what? I'm so grateful to be here. I'm so grateful to be sober, to be standing here, to have 1 year again. I keep having drinking dreams this week. And waking up thinking, oh no, they're going to fucking kill me. You know, and then I wake up and I'm like, oh, thank you, thank you. You know, with AA is like, it's like a campfire in the wilderness. You know, and I'm running out there, and this is how I felt. I was running, and these wolves are howling and nipping at my heels and shredding my clothes. You know, and I'm just running my ass off. And I get to the campfire, and it's warm, and my sponsor's there, and my network's there, and they're drinking coffee, and they're telling stories. And every now and then, another one will run in, shredded clothes, puffing and puffing. I just made it. And we remember. Because that's what it is. You know, we have a good time in here and laugh, but it's so much warmer around the fire than it is out there by myself. I'm just grateful to be here. I'm so grateful. Thank you.